All right.
All right.
Well, welcome everybody to another edition of the Omaha Bar Association Bar Talk Podcast. This is Dave Summers, Executive Director of the Omaha Bar Association, and I am here today in the office of Daniel Gutman. We are right across from the courthouse here on the third floor of the Empire Building?
The awkwardly named Empire State Building.
It's three stories? It's not quite New York level of Empire.
No.
Okay. Building's probably been here for quite a while, though, right?
It had been here for over 100 years. I know that there was, or about 100 years, it had a lot of lawyers come through here. A lot of lawyers from the law offices. And a while ago, I'm blanking on his name, but there was a big law firm down here because we're right across the street from the courthouse. So that's why the bar on the corner is called the Bird.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yes. We are opposite of the Key Line. The Key Line's on the east side of the courthouse complex. We are on the west side. So, Daniel, we've been meeting to get you on the pod actually for a number of years. You seem to be doing things at a crazy rate. And so we wanted to get your story and hear about what you're doing now. I've known you as a good OBA member coming to things since I started in this position. Can you give us kind of a background on growing up and what took you to law school?
Sure. I absolutely, so I grew up here in Omaha, went to high school right up the street at Omaha Central. After high school, I went to undergrad in Washington, D.C., where I know you lived as well and went to school.
Yeah.
Unlike Dave Summers, I did not get into Georgetown.
Neither did I the first time. I was a transfer, so I got into the side door. So
we American University grads call ourselves Georgetown Rejects. So I went to American University and worked for 5 years after law school. So it was funny. I was 27. I thought I was like the youngest person ever. And then I go to law school. I find out that I'm like the oldest person.
Yeah.
So during those 5 years, I did a lot of nonprofits related work. I worked in Alabama and Mississippi and Louisiana and Florida, working on juvenile justice project, working with kids who are incarcerated in adult facilities. And then I worked back to Washington, D.C. before I went to law school to work on the implementation of a U.S. Supreme Court case called Miller versus Alabama, which held unconstitutional mandatory life without parole sentences imposed on children. And so the Supreme Court comes out with this decision, says that this sentence is unconstitutional. We had 2,500 kids that were serving that sentence, that something needed to happen to them. We had states throughout the country that had laws that had just been deemed unconstitutional. They weren't planning on that happening, so they had these laws they had to change. So I kind of bopped around the country and helped states implement new laws, including here in Nebraska. And so did that for a number of years, and eventually dawned on me, I should probably go to law school.
I feel like you're headed there at some point anyway, right?
Yes. Now, when I was 22, right out of college, the last thing on earth I thought it was law school. That's why it was funny when I went to law school, these people that went straight through, I just kept thinking to myself, man, at 22 and 23, law school was not high on my priority list. But it got there, and I ended up coming back to Nebraska, living back to Nebraska for law school, and finished at University of Nebraska, clerked for Judge Girard for 2 years after law school. That was a great, great experience. Worked at Fraser Stryker for 3 years doing commercial litigation work, and then started my own practice about 2 years ago.
And what drew you to the juvenile justice work after college? What was that that brought you to that?
It was kind of happenstance. I had worked on a political campaign right out of college. The campaign ended, and as I think you're a former campaign person.
I'm a campaign rat. Yep.
Yeah. You what happens is you work your tail off, and then the election happens, and then you wake up the next day and you say, oh, wait, I'm out of a job. And so I spent a couple months looking for a job, and I had a professor in undergrad who I hope we can talk about later because he's relevant to the First Amendment context as well, who had a connection with an organization down in Alabama doing juvenile justice work. And I went and I talked to him, and he said, hey, I think they're hiring, and plugged me in down there. I didn't know anything about juvenile justice when I went down there, and I just totally got sucked into that world and worked on it for 5 years.
And now you are from a lawyer family. Your dad does have a law degree, even if he doesn't necessarily practice, right?
But I have to be reminded of that because he does have a law degree. He did practice in the public defender's office for a few years, but he gave up the practice of law before I was even born. So I don't know him as a lawyer, but technically, yes, he is a lawyer.
And any brothers, sisters?
I have a brother who is a Middle East history professor out in New York. Yeah, not a lawyer.
Oh. Yeah. And so you leave Fraser Strike or commercial litigation for your own practice. What were you looking to do? Why did you make that change?
I made the change mainly because I felt like I had gotten a lot of really good experience in private practice doing commercial litigation. Really, really good experience. I would not have been able to make this move if I hadn't done that. But I got to a point where I really wanted to focus more on just the cases and the issues that I am really interested in. So, for example, one of my strong interests is in election law. I'm really interested in ballot initiatives and direct democracy efforts. And when you're at a big firm, you know, it's hard to just focus just on that because there's so many other things coming through the door. And so that was a big reason why I made the transition. And then also to work a little bit more closely with different nonprofits around Nebraska, helping them both with litigation issues, but also just kind of internal compliance issues and 501c3 status and those kind of things.
This is the obligatory plug for the Just the Basics Election Law CLE, which you can watch on YouTube, or I believe we have it on our podcast in audio only. The election law work that you've done has been pretty significant. And again, as a campaign guy myself in the past life, there's a lot to it, and certainly it's been in the headlines over the last couple of years, election law, and a lot of we've never seen it at. But access to voting systems that are allowed for people with disabilities is certainly something that has been out there. But what was a case that you worked on that you can tell us about?
Sure. One of the things that I'm really interested in is Nebraska allows access to the ballot through direct democracy. And what I mean by that is if a group of people think that the legislature isn't doing enough on a particular issue, they can go out and gather enough signatures and they can put it on the ballot themselves and have the people vote on it. And I don't always get involved in the policy debates about who wants to get on the ballot for what. I'm more interested in the legal process for getting on the ballot, regardless of what the issue is. I think it's really important that we have a direct channel. The people are the legislature in Nebraska. Nebraska's constitution is set up in a way where the people are the second house, right? We're a unicameral. We have one body in the legislature, not two. And the people are supposed to be the second body. So preserving that right and getting access to the ballot is something that's really interesting to me. So two cases come to mind. One was in 2020 where a group of people wanted to put a rate on how much payday lenders could impose on payday loans. It was about 435% interest rate before. Group of people got together and said, hey, that's too high. and they took it to the ballot. And we had a number of procedural challenges that went up to the Nebraska Supreme Court and made some case law on that. The other is a more complicated case that we actually ended up losing at the Eighth Circuit, but it dealt with Nebraska's requirement that if you want to get on the ballot, you not only have to get a total amount of signatures, those signatures need to come from 5% of voters in 38 of Nebraska's 93 counties. Exactly. And so we call that 38 county rule. There's issues that we argued of vote dilution there, some First Amendment issues. We got a good ruling in the district court, and it was appealed up to the Eighth Circuit, and the Eighth Circuit reversed that in a divided panel. And so the 38 county rule still stands, but those are cases that really stick out to me.
And the other one that's, I guess, been out there in recent years was with medical marijuana and it being a single issue, so that when it is put on the ballot, it is simple enough for people to understand, and it isn't a compound thing where you say yes because you're siding with one, inarguably siding with the other. And I guess it's unfair to the voters to have them decide two things at once, right? Correct. Single issue rule.
Yeah, single contact rule. And that is in 2020, medical marijuana group got off the ballot.
Lancaster Sheriff, I believe, was correct. That was interesting. So you're doing election law stuff, and then you're also working with your dad, doing some fundraising for nonprofits around town, which is exciting. I know there's legal nonprofits that you guys are working with. Gutman and Associates is known far and wide in the nonprofit circles for doing that work, and you're working with Gutman and Associates, great last name, great name of a firm. And you guys have done some really significant work, I know, with JFON, now Immigrant Legal Center, over the years, raised really significant funds for some of these organizations to make a difference in the community and you know, working with legal aid now. Things like
that. Yeah, that's Gutman and Associates is my dad's company, and I do a little bit of work with them. Probably 95% of my work is legal and not that, but they do a lot of really important work around nonprofit fundraising.
It's so important in this community, especially. Yeah. I don't know how many other places in the country are, well, you need money. Don't look to the government first. Look to your philanthropic community for a lot of help there. And maybe the government comes along at some point, but the funds usually come from private sources, where in other places it'd be more public thing. It's a private-public partnership that we like to throw out there in Omaha, which I don't know, I've never seen that anywhere else. It just seems like a very unique thing here.
Yeah, huge nonprofit community here. Unprecedented, really.
So now you have a new thing, because you're not busy enough. And you just had another child, right?
So, yeah. Lee.
Congratulations. You are talking to me looking fabulous. You are just completely well rested. Everything. We're on the radio, so we can, or we're on podcast, so we don't have to see what state you're in after just having your newborn. So now you're on to a new initiative with all things going on. You're doing something new down at Nebraska College of Law on First Amendment. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think most importantly, I think the way I put it to you in a text message right before this is that I look like I got hit by a truck. So I'm glad that this is audio only. There's a really, really exciting new clinic at the University of Nebraska. They got a very large contribution from a foundation called the Stanton Foundation. And the Stanton Foundation has picked a number of universities around the country, a number of law schools, to give them 3 years worth of funding for a First Amendment. And the hope is we, you know, we graduate a lot of people from Creighton in Nebraska that know how to do criminal law, and they know how to do divorces, and they know how to do car accident cases and really important work. We don't graduate a lot of people who know how to do constitutional claims, and in particular, First Amendment claims, media law, for example. It just since I've taken this position, I talked to a lawyer for the Nebraska Press Association, some different press outlets throughout the state. Their lawyer is actually based in Kansas because they can't find somebody that really specializes in this area in Nebraska. And so the point of the clinic is really to take on, fill a void in First Amendment law and really train the new generation of lawyers in this kind of work. And so the University of Nebraska will start next January, will be the first cohort of students. Myself, and then there's a co-director named Sydney Hayes, who came from Hush Blackwell. We will be directing the clinic on top of our kind of private practice work. The thought is that you bring in a clinical instructor who's not doing that full time, also has, you know, their own practice to really ingrain the students in different litigation skills. And so we started last month, and we have 4 months just to kind of go out and talk about the clinic and let people know that it exists. Hopefully different lawyers and people hear about it and can refer us cases. And we'll be off and running in January.
And Nebraska College of Law has a real emphasis on clinic work, don't they? I mean, they've just gotten money for their juvenile clinic, their juvenile justice clinic. They are investing a lot of money and grant resources into clinical experiences for law lawyers, which I'm on board with for sure, coming from a law school that had that requirement of clinical experience and having worked cases before you get out of law school. I think that's great for everybody, but it seems like it's a big emphasis down in Nebraska.
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, I want to say that over the past few years, they've had 8 different clinical programs. I mean, students there will be able to pick from, you want to go to criminal prosecution or defense, you can go into the criminal clinic. You want to do civil work, there's a civil clinic. Juvenile work, a juvenile clinic. And now we're going to have a First Amendment clinic. And while the focus is First Amendment, I mean, so much of these claims are civil procedure and immunity and different areas of civil rights law that are very generally applicable. So we're going to focus on the First Amendment, but students in that clinic are going to learn how to be civil rights practitioners, whether they want to go work for a civil rights firm or they want to work for the government or the state or the attorney general, you know, anybody defending these kind of claims. It's going to be a really practical experience.
And there is something to be said for First Amendment cases, you know, plaintiffs that have potential causes of action, not always wanting to invest the money in a private practice attorney to bring that claim. And so a clinic experience actually probably helps push forward some legitimate claims to have attorneys working on them with law students or by law students.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the difficulties with the First Amendment and, I mean, with really any constitutional claim, especially if it's against a government body, is depending on what the government body is, like the state, for example, there's different immunities for money damages. So it's hard if your First Amendment rights have been violated. It's hard, A, to pay a lawyer to go out and get the relief you need. And even a lawyer who's doing it on contingency, if there's no money damages, there's no contingency. So you're exactly right. It's filling a void there that needs to be filled in the state.
And estimate size of the clinic here, starting, what do you think?
We will have up to 8 students, just like the other clinics have up to 8. And so we'll have 2, myself and Sydney, directing, and up to 8 students.
How many cases do you think you could do with that, if you were really cranking it, the whole 8 students?
If we were all hands on deck, we would think max 4. The thought
is semester or at a time, I guess.
At a time. Yeah. And so that's the other difference between this clinic and some of the others. In some of the others, the cases come and go pretty quickly. In this kind of clinic, depending on the case, you could have a case that lasts years. So the hope is that if we have 8 students, we have 4 groups of 2. Right. Thank you. Orders of two. Each of those groups would have a case that they were working on, and then also some other project that's not necessarily litigation focused. So maybe they're giving presentations, they're talking to press outlets about Open Records Act, you know, those kind of things.
And that is part of it, is educating in advance of litigation or instead of litigation, what an entity should be doing. Yes, we can sue you for this, but you're going to lose. Here's the standard. Maybe forgoing some litigation at some point because people understand better. They have to turn that over under the law, or they can't say that you can't do this under the law. So keeping some outside the courts is part of what they're doing with the education side of it.
Maybe. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, litigation is hard for the group defending it, but it's also hard for the group bringing it. And so if we can advance First Amendment principles without having to file lawsuits, that is a huge victory. And so those are the things that we'll be focusing on.
And I mean, there may be people out there that say First Amendments, you know, they see it as a one side of the political spectrum. But from my past experience, on your university campus doing freedom of association cases, it was really the plaintiffs were a conservative group wanting to promote that the freedom of association. I mean, there's a lot to First Amendment that's not on any one political side. It is just constitutional right in general, not political.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's really one of the only conditions of this grant to the university is the grantor, the Stanton Foundation, really wants these clinics to be true First Amendment believers. And what we mean by that is we want to represent people and entities on any political spectrum, even non-political. I mean, even what we might take cases pertaining to speech that both myself, the co-director, and the students find reprehensible, and both political parties find reprehensible. But it's important, if we're a true First Amendment clinic, we need to be ready to represent First Amendment rights, regardless of how they come to us. And so that's really what we're going to be promoting, is that we are true believers in the First Amendment. We're not looking for a particular type of case or a particular political outcome. We want to take on true First Amendment cases because the thought is, if we can represent people in true First Amendment cases, it benefits everybody, not just that person, not just that statement that we don't like. We can get good case law protecting the First Amendment, regardless of the context, it benefits everybody.
And there is history with ACLU in a similar situation, right? People opinion them, liberal, but they have been working on cases in favor of positions that are certainly not liberal. And it's really about promoting your civil liberties, not necessarily a point of view politically.
Exactly. That's going to be important.
So 3 years of runway, as they say, and we'll see what happens from the foundation, from the university, from the success of the program. And probably reassess it. You're one and a half when you're just getting your feet underneath you, right?
Yeah, that's the thought is they're gonna fund these different universities, different clinics. They'll go in and do assessments, and you know, depending on how things are, they might permanently endow some. So certainly, we'd love to have a permanently endowed clinic at the university for First Amendment cases. We'll see. No pressure.
No pressure at all. At all. Let's see. I have sort of gone through all the questions in my head, but I'm sure that I've forgotten something. There was something I was supposed to ask you, we were supposed to talk about, or it's just open mic for the good of the order. Anything you want to add?
Well, one of the things that I have found is really cool is I mentioned earlier that I had a professor who, at American University, who kind of steered me down south where I got involved in general justice work. That professor was Julian Bond, who was a really well-known civil rights activist of the 60s. He has since passed. And he was a very close mentor to me, friend of mine. And I've been thinking a lot about him with this new clinic, because he actually has a seminal First Amendment case named after. He's the namesake of Bond versus Floyd, which was a case in the 70s. He was elected to the Georgia legislature. And when he got to the legislature refused to seat him because he had endorsed a public statement that opposed the Vietnam War. And they said, because you are supporting this, it's against the legislature's values and decorum, and you're not going to be able to be seated. And that case went up to the Supreme Court on a First Amendment theory. And of course, he prevailed there and he was seated. And it's kind of the seminal First Amendment case about speech and restrictions and government interference. And so it's just this really interesting culmination. And interestingly enough, my son, who is 1 week old now, his middle name is Julian.
That's great. That's wonderful. Well, and I'm always heartened to see attorneys that follow their passions and make sure that they're doing the work that is true to them. And your story of pursuing this is, I think, instructive to people that are saying, well, gosh, my opportunities after law school are, you know, these two things. It's not exactly what I wanted to do. You can write your own story. You can find a way to get to where you're doing what you want to do. You go home. Doesn't feel like work, right? It's really fulfilling. And so I love to share your story because, you're doing amazing work in the community, and, you seem like the happiest attorney I know. So you must be doing something right.
You put it right. I worked for somebody actually in Alabama who would say that. He would say, you know, I'm at the office a lot. It just doesn't feel like work. Like, I love what I'm doing. And that's always what I've aspired to do. When I was in private practice at a law firm, I loved the work. And I loved the people. And but I knew it wasn't my long-term calling. I knew that because I had worked in it. I had had the feeling of being completely passionate about my work, and I wasn't there, and so I knew I could get back to it. So I'm glad I did it. It's hard, right? It's very difficult when you're off on your own, and you know, even have baby, and I don't have the leave policy,
right?
So it's difficult, but I certainly wouldn't trade it for anything.
We'll try to roll this into Solo School, which is one of the conversation series that I've done. Any tips for anybody looking to go out there and start their own law firm? Any things that pitfalls that you would say avoid this? Maybe if not a tip of doing something better, but avoiding this.
Anything? Yeah, I mean, I guess, as a general matter, one tip I'd have, especially for younger lawyers who are in private practice, some people know, for example, a bigger firm life, that's for them, and that's great. And other people have this feeling in their stomach, right? And they say, oh, this isn't for me. But they try and convince themselves that it is for them. And I did for a long time. I can try to convince myself, oh, this is what I need to be doing long term.
We're lawyers. We persuade others. We can persuade ourselves.
Yeah, you know, I would really resist that. I would tell people to resist it. You know, if you have that gut feeling that it's not right, or maybe it's not a long term thing, you know, we only got one shot at this, and you know, I would pursue that. And in terms of people wanting to start their own business, I mean, one thing that worked for me is I had some opportunities going into it, so. Some people told me, you know, if you go off on your own, there's this kind of work that needs to be done, and we could engage you for that. So it wasn't going offline, right? Like I had some stuff set up. And then the other thing that I live by is something that a partner at Fraser Stryker told me. It was a little bit farther in his career, and I had just started at Fraser, and I wanted to take on everything. Everybody that called me, I wanted to take on those. And he just said, "Hey, slow down. Like, I know you want to take on everything, but if that actually detracts you from doing what you want to do." And so I think of it, that's always top of mind for me when I get calls and opportunities here. And it's, am I actually going to be able to help on this? Am I actually going to be able to get a good outcome? And is it a smart thing business?
It's tough to say as a soul, your own business, to say, I'm going to turn this way. I'm going to say, this isn't the right fit. You want to help everybody. You want to have that income coming in. You want to do well. And it's tough to say no, but sometimes that means that your other cases are better served. You're better served, that you're in it for the long haul. You don't burn out.
Exactly.
Well, anything else before we end this podcast and they hear that lovely outro music?
Well, I hope that anybody listening will check out the First Amendment Clinic at the University of Nebraska. We have a website. We have a submission form where people can submit requests for help. If people have clients that come to them with First Amendment concerns that they're not able to help with, please direct them our way. And we'd be happy to talk to people and get students involved in those cases. Even if it's just an intake, even if it doesn't go anywhere, there's so much value for students to be able to read an intake form and to talk to somebody and think about representation. And even if it doesn't result in anything, write them a letter saying, sorry, I can't help. I mean, there's so much value in things that we attorneys, go through every day, but students haven't done that yet. And so I hope that people will think of us at the university.
I'll definitely get this over to Donna and Lawyer Referral Service. If we get any calls at the Wild Bar Association, we'll be sending everyone.
Great.
Thanks.
Thanks, Dave.